have been jailed in one of these countries for what he said if he weren't the leader of the self-proclaimed Jewish state, which kind of guarantees him immunity. He got a light slap on the wrist from the Anti-Defamation League, which thanked him for his clarification, even though he didn't clarify at all. He merely doubled down on his outrageous remarks. Now we have to ask why Netanyahu is doing this. Why is Netanyahu consistently attempting to displace blame for the Jewish genocide in Europe from the Germans onto the Palestinians? Of course, Netanyahu throughout his career has been determined to shatter the Palestinian national struggle, to discredit it, and to justify his campaign, his violent campaign against it. But with what's happening in Jerusalem, Netanyahu's fanaticism has risen to the surface.
Max, I found it curious that just recently, since these attacks have been going on, he has been quite measured in terms of his comments. Netanyahu came out and actually issued a statement saying that enticing violence and this kind of attacks on Palestinians by crowds, for example, in the bus station, is violating the law. What do you make of these recent statements against this one?
A week ago, Netanyahu pledged to chop off the arms of his enemies, complimenting comments months before by former Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman that Palestinian citizens of Israel who are disloyal should be beheaded with axes. Netanyahu is a master of incitement. And after the shooting of an innocent Eritrean refugee at a bus station in Beersheba, and the gory snuff film that emerged showing an Israeli mob trouncing the dying corpse of this refugee, no one, not one Israeli official for 2 days said a word of condemnation. And the opposition leader, Isaac Herzog, his condemnation was weak at best. So I think Netanyahu, what we're seeing here is an escalation of incitement. Part of the Zionist narrative is that the Jews of Europe failed to resist. They went like sheep to the slaughter during the Holocaust, and that their redemption has arrived by arming themselves to the teeth in historic Palestine, forming a garrison Spartan state, a Fort Apache on the front lines of the clash of civilizations, and defending themselves even with nuclear energy against a second Holocaust. And that's sort of a narrative that Netanyahu accepts. It's what he believes. It explains his whole career and why he speaks the way he does. And it's also a narrative that's present in American Jewish popular culture. It explains the popularity of the Tarantino film Inglourious Basterds, which is about a mythical or imaginary unit of American Jews who go into the woods of Europe and slaughter Nazis. In one scene, they extrajudicially execute a Nazi officer who had been captured by slamming his head open with a baseball bat. Unfortunately for Netanyahu, these fantasies can't be realized. Israel finds itself, after its failed campaign to stoke a war against Iran, which Netanyahu said was led by a modern Hitler, it finds itself up against 12-year-old and 15-year-old stone throwers, teenagers who've grown up under occupation behind walls, who've been ghettoized and dispossessed and excluded. And these are the people that Netanyahu is telling, is saying are responsible for the Holocaust, who at least bear the spiritual legacy of Nazi Germany. That is the most dangerous incitement possible. And we know, let me just make this one last point. We know that Netanyahu's words have consequences. Just over 20 years ago today, Netanyahu stood in the center of Jerusalem at a rally of settlers who were holding posters depicting his political rival, Yitzhak Rabin, in an SS uniform as a Nazi. Netanyahu proceeded to march next to a mock coffin labeled Rabin. This is Netanyahu's rival. A month later, Rabin had been assassinated by a right-wing fanatic, and Netanyahu was on his way to being elected prime minister. So this in specialty and incitement explains Netanyahu's career and his legacy.
Now, that's going to be my exact question. Where are the Rabinites that supported his candidacy, and where are the Jews in Israel on these kinds of comments?
Well, Netanyahu is not alone in making these kind of comments, displacing blame for the Holocaust onto Palestinians, from the Germans onto Palestinians. Although Netanyahu's kind of mentor, one of the first leader of the Likud party, Menachem Begin, who is a longtime leader of Likud's predecessor, Herut, was really responsible for introducing this kind of rhetoric about and exploiting the Holocaust in Israeli life. But it, you know, you've seen it across the spectrum, and especially in Jewish Israeli society. The first time I visited the Yad Vashem Holocaust Memorial Museum and Research Center in Jerusalem, which I believe is funded by the Israeli government, and is a requisite stop for any American official who visits Israel. I noticed that the only Palestinian in the museum was on display at the end of the tour. You go through the whole tour of the horrors of the Holocaust, and then on your way out, you see a display of the Mufti meeting with Nazi officials, suggesting that Palestinians had some kind of direct role in the Holocaust. And then you're on your way out into a sweeping view of Jerusalem, which is portrayed, you know, psychologically as deliverance from thousands of years of Jewish genocide and suffering. So this is even present in Yad Vashem. Yad Vashem's Encyclopedia of the Holocaust contains entries for major Nazi officials, Himmler and Goebbels and Hitler, of course. Their entries are shorter than that of the Mufti. Why does the Mufti receive so much attention in this encyclopedia? Because the history of the Holocaust in the official narrative of the Holocaust in Israel is heavily politicized to suit the Zionist narrative. It's a segregationist narrative, and it has been exploited to indict the Palestinians and portray them as the new anti-Semites. So this incitement is present throughout Zionist literature. You see it, you can just do a Google search for the Mufti and the Nazis, and you'll find reams and reams of material published by neoconservative fanatics like David Horowitz on these links. And the Mufti did meet with Hitler in November 28, 1941. The Times of Israel has just published a readout of their meeting. And there's simply no evidence that what Netanyahu claimed is even remotely true. And what Netanyahu claimed is that Hitler was just following orders. The Mufti made him do it, influenced him, and told him to burn the Jews. And in that meeting, in the readout, there's no evidence. So Netanyahu has fabricated this claim, doubled down on it. And at one of the most dangerous times possible, when Palestinians in Jerusalem, who are basically defenseless, are being targeted in vigilante attacks, and Jewish Israelis are facing stabbing attacks. This is what Netanyahu has chosen to do. He's chosen to pour gasoline on the fire.
Max Blumenthal, I really appreciate you coming on such short notice to address these comments and set the record straight.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for joining us on the Real News Network.
Palestinian health officials say a UN school in northern Gaza has been attacked by Israeli tanks. Harry Fear, he's in Gaza. He's got the latest.
Well, this incident follows another heavy night of bombardment in Gaza. We understand over 120 Palestinians were killed last night. Just in the last couple of hours, we've heard this incident of the United Nations school being used as a shelter hit by Israeli tank shells. We understand more than one shell hit. First, the courtyard, and also, secondly, part of the school, which is primarily used by the girl pupils. We understand that civilians were, of course, sheltering in these areas. areas. This shelling of a United Nations school constitutes the second act of violence against a UN school in less than a week. Last Thursday, a United Nations school in the north of the Strip in Beit Hanun was struck in similar circumstances. Under contention with regard to Israel and Hamas, both obviously giving different explanations for the violence. But certainly on the ground, we're seeing again continued hostilities, of course, and this is another significant incident. Now, over five United Nations schools have been caught up in the fighting, which is now, of course, beginning to move now onto its 23rd day. Well, yesterday we saw another significant incident, which was the targeting of the fuel tanks belonging to Gaza's sole power station. Gaza has been suffering from fuel and electricity crises on and off for several years since the Israeli and Egyptian imposed siege began. This now is obviously only going to worsen the electricity crisis for civilians here in the Strip. Well, we've been catching up with some of those hit most horrendously with awful injuries in Gaza's main hospital, the Al-Shifa Hospital.
It's hard to fathom how such vast devastation can occur in 3 weeks of fighting. Thousands of homes damaged or destroyed, tens of thousands internally displaced, well over 1,000 killed. Inside Gaza's main hospital, in its burns unit, are a small fraction of the surviving injured.
This girl, 3 years old, the Israelis demolished their house of this family. So we received the girl, her mother, two brothers with severe burns this morning.
This woman is in a very severe condition, obviously.
She is. She presented to us about 5 days ago with her son and her husband. Her son and husband died with severe, massive burns, and she's still surviving with a very critical condition.
The doctors and nurses here look as stunned as the civilians who've survived in heavily bombarded areas. It's hard to imagine how the medical staff can cope with these truly horrendous cases.
I'm a human being. If I see whole families killed under the rubble of their house, the house is demolished on these people, and all the family is killed. In one of the instances, I had a child here. He was all the time crying because he lost all his families. He lost his father, his mother, his brothers, his grandfather, and all the time he's crying, he wants his father, his mother. So I closed the door of my office and I sat crying here.
Those that survive this war will have to bear the physical and psychological scars for years to come. As for what weaponry is causing these injuries, it's not entirely clear.
The type of injuries we are having is very severe. The magnitude of destruction of the human beings. Those bombs are intended to kill mass casualties of people. The bodies and faces are burned badly.
On the ground, it feels as if during this war, Israel is firmly fixed on stopping Hamas's rockets once and for all, regardless of the incredible civilian toll. Harry Fear, RT, Gaza.
And the Al-Aqsa television channel has now broadcast video showing Hamas fighters infiltrating Israeli territory to attack a guard post. Five Israeli soldiers.
For all occasions. And everyone got excited about the technology, and I guess it was pretty incredible watching a missile fly down an air vent. Pretty unbelievable. But couldn't we feasibly use that same technology to shoot food at hungry people?
This one is dedicated to the suit-wearing arms dealers, to the champagne-sipping depleted uranium droppers.
Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone.
First in my scope is BAE Systems. Specialize in killing people from a distance. Power is a drug and they feed the addiction. Immediate deletion of people's existence. Who says what isn't legitimate resistance? To push these buttons, you don't need a brave heart. State of the art darts leave more than your face scarred. You might impress an A&R with your fake bars. Cause you probably think Rolls Royce only make cars. This is for the colonizers, turn bomb providers. Take this beef all the way back to Oppenheimer. They call it warfare, but your wars aren't fair. If they were, they'd be suicide bombers in arms fairs. A scam for the funds, they will mangle your son. If you try to speak out, they will stamp on your tongue. To your land they will come, till you stand up as one, it's begun.
Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone.
Next in my scope is Lockheed Martin. They will tell you when the bombs need blasting. Don't think, just listen to the songs, keep dancing. Do they really want us to have our own brains? Who do you think is really running Guantanamo Bay? And it might be sensitive, but I'll mention it. Who do you think's got us filling out the censuses? Who do you think is handing out the sentences? This ain't the BBC, so there's no censorship. Heard of many mercenaries getting with the clever pimp. Not a gun seller, but none's better than Eric Prince. Make money off many things, mainly it's crime. This one is dedicated to the Raytheon 9. On a scam for the funds, they will mangle your son. If you try to speak out, they will stamp on your tongue. To your land, they will come, till you stand up as one, it's begun.
Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone.
One half sunny and
this condition?
Yeah. Here.
And have them. It's the paradigm of the wagon train versus the swarthy hordes. First enunciated very well by in a marvelous article by Tom Engelhardt in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. It could be happening in the American Wild West, it could be in the Amazon jungle, the North African desert, the Sudan, the Transvaal, the South Pacific jungles, or Indochina. The scene is generally the same. There's a fort, or an encampment, or a wagon train. And inside that encampment are the human beings. They're white. They're human. They're warm, they're attractive, they talk, and they're nice. Outside come the swarthy hordes, the savages. They can be Indians, they can be Bushmen, they can be Arabs on camels and horses or whatever else. And they are the subhumans, and they are attacking the human beings. And the wagons form their circle, and the human beings know what to do. They level their guns and they begin to knock off, shoot, and kill these screaming savages who attack them. Why do the swarthy hordes attack the white people? You don't know. They never tell you. Is it to protect their lands? Is it to protect their herds? Is it to protect their villages and their towns and their families and their children? No, it's just because they like to do that. That's their thing. They like to attack. And so they have to be killed. And by the way, it's not even bravery that they manifest. As they charge in great numbers and get cut down in horrible numbers, this is not even bravery, although similar acts by whites would be portrayed as heroic. This itself is portrayed as a manifestation of the swarthy hordes, their fanatic, crazed way of wanting to bloodlust. Now, the trouble with this paradigm is that it turns the history of the last 400 years on its head. That it reverses the roles of usurper and usurped. It reverses the roles of victim and victimizer. It reverses the roles of those who were massacred and those who were doing the massacring. It was the European and North American civilizers, so-called, who went in there and destroyed the villages and destroyed their industries and destroyed their townships.
Read Engels on North Africa, what happened to the Arabs and Berbers, and when he goes in and describes the beautiful towns with the fine, hard stone and plaster buildings and their woolen industries and their mining industries and their arts and crafts and all that, and then read the description of the French troops coming in and systematically destroying it and killing every man, woman, and child. Read about how the Germans went into South Africa and killed the Herero tribe. 80,000 people, they killed 60,000 of them, and the other 20,000 they used as slave labor in their mines. Read Mark Twain's angry, raging comments about King Leopold of Belgium, calling him a mad dog and what he did to the innocent, unoffending people of the Congo, taking them and enslaving them, a million of them a year dying in the mines in the Congo. That's what the history's about. That's what John Wayne is about. And what these films do is they reverse that history, stand it on its head. They do what Joseph Goebbels said. They give you a big lie, and they embellish it, and they make you root for the guys in the wagon train.
I am not angry, I am anger. I am not dangerous, I am danger. I am abominable stress, idiotic, relentless. I'm a breath of vengeance, I'm a death sentence. I'm forsaken repentance to the beast and his henchmen, armed forces and policemen that survive off of oil and prisons of today. Cup one is over with lost souls that wear oversized caps like blindfolds, shiny necklaces like lassos, dragging them into black holes. And I may have to holler at Fidel Castro to get my other brothers out of Guantanamo. And the innocents on death row is probably in the same proportion as the criminals in black robes, that smack gavels that crack domes, that smack gavels that smash homes. Justice is somewhere in between reading sad poems and 40 ounces of gasoline crashing through windows. It is between plans and action. It is between writing letters to congressmen and clapping the captain. It is between raising legal defense funds and put a gun on the bailiff and taking the judge captive. It is between prayer and fasting, between burning and blasting. Freedom is between the mind and the soul, between a lock and the load, between the zeal of the young and the patience of the old. Freedom is between the finger and the trigger. It is between the page and the pen. It is between the grenade and the pen. Between righteous anger keeping one in the chamber. So what can they do with a cat with a heart like Turner, a mind like Douglas, a mouth like Malcolm, and a voice like Chris? Why I am not dangerous, I am danger. I am not angry, I am anger. I am abominable stress, idiotic, relentless. I'm a death sentence to the beast and his henchmen, politicians and big businessmen. I'm a teenage Palestinian opening fire at an Israeli checkpoint, point blank, checkmate, now what? I'm a rape victim with a gun cocked to his cock, cock, bang, bang, cock, now what? I am Sitting Bull with Colonel Custer's scalp in my hands. I am Sin K with a slave traded blood on my hands. I am Jonathan Jackson handing a gun to my man. I am David with a slingshot and a rock. And if David lived today, he'd have a Molotov cocktail and a Glock. So down with Goliath. I say down with Goliath, but we must learn. No, right, read, we must kick, bite, yell, scream, we must pray, fast, live, dream, fight, kill, and die free.
Back in the USSR, we'll be back after this short break.
You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM.
If you have a local business, event, or initiative that you would like to promote, CFRU can help you out. Free public service announcements are available to all not-for-profit events and organizations, while for-profits have the option to choose from an ad package that is competitively priced to give you the highest quality ad at the best deals available. A staff member will guide you through the entire process and ensure that you are pleased with the final result before it is put on air. If you are interested in having an ad or PSA run on our station, please contact outreach at cfru.ca for more information.
It is no surprise that one of CFRU's longest running and most popular programs is Clan na Gael. We feature 2 hours of the best Celtic music from around the world and around the corner. Listen on Sundays after the BBC World News at noon, Tune in and get your fill of fiddles, whistles, banjos, mandolins, bowrons, harps, flutes, and wonderful voices. And of course, let's not forget everyone's favorite Celtic musical instrument, the bagpipes. Clan na Gael is the most bagpipe-friendly show on CFRU FM 93.3. Join me, John Fahey, on Sundays and start your own Celtic Kitchen Ceilidh.
If you or anyone close to you is experiencing distress, depression, substance issues, or any mental health challenges right now, please know that Connect's Ontario helplines are available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, staffed by information and referral specialists who can help. The toll-free number is 1-866-531-2600. That's 1-866-531-2600. You can also chat online or email specialists via the website mentalhealthhelpline.ca. These services are available to those in distress as well as family and friends concerned about someone close to them. The toll-free number, once more, is 1-866-531-2600. This message is brought to you by Connects Ontario Helplines and CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph's community radio station.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM, CFRU. So before the break, we had Amir Suleiman, one of my favorite spoken word poets, actually doing a poem of his titled Danger. And of course, we had Michael Parenti before that with an excerpt from his talk, Ramble in the Swarthy Hordes, which I'm actually going to play a little more later on. But of course, what he was talking about there is the paradigm of the wagon train versus the swarthy hordes. You know, this kind of frontier mentality you get in, you know, certainly in settler societies, you get in like with colonial empires and in general, and how those who resist colonialism are portrayed are basically demonized, you know. And this is a very strong theme you even see today in the media, in the entertainment world. But of course, it's also, of course, in politics as well, especially if you're looking at a society like Israel, which is effectively a highly racist society. A society that effectively, I didn't play it on the show here tonight, but I mean, Abby Martin did a number of interviews. I know Max Blumenthal has done this too, where he actually went to Israel and just talked to people about Palestinians. The amount of racism, the racist response that he got from just ordinary people on the street, and, you know, the majority of the cases, the people he interviewed were giving that kind of response. It was almost like living in the American West and like 100 years ago or something like that, and asking people about what they thought about indigenous people. It was that kind of response. You know, these Israelis, they looked on Palestinians as savages, you know, as people who should be, you know, not full human beings, subhumans, people who should be expelled, wiped out, even like genocide inflicted on them. This was like the general attitude that they were finding on the streets of Israel. And that's scary. You know, that's an immensely scary thing. This is how much demonization there has been of the Palestinians. And this is the kind of attitudes that a settler society produces, a settler colonial society, where, you know, people who fight against colonialism, the indigenous people, they're demonized and treated as subhuman. And that is then used to justify all these atrocities against them. You know, and of course, I played Harry Fear's report there from RT when he was covering the Israel's assault on Gaza, on the Gaza Strip in 2015. And it's a pretty harrowing thing, which he was covering there, like experience he had on the ground in Gaza. He was there quite a number of times, and deeply affected him. And of course, we had Max Blumenthal talking about the Israeli government actually trying to blame the Palestinians for the Holocaust, like, you know, the ultimate attempt to demonize, you know, of course, there's like zero evidence for that. And like, which almost like he's almost like almost letting the Nazis off the hook, you know, in Benjamin Netanyahu's attempt to demonize the Palestinians. You know, like, this is the lengths that they're willing to go. It's pretty, once again, it's very frightening, like seeing that, these racist attempts to demonize the Palestinian people. and trying to use that to justify the atrocities committed against them. You know, so in a little bit, I'm going to play actually the full talk by Michael Parenti, where he talks about these things. But right now, we're going to take another musical interlude. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Yeah. 1, 2, 1, 2. Flow combat, be I born that, beaches thorn that, reformat the masses, I'm redrafting the battle map, sat top of task list, I build a classic boom bap blast, bazooka rap shit, I'm sending heads into backspin, attack with wind at the back, plus vernaculars to dig it back by facts, packed with the stat charts and graphs, I got passion, burn mics up to ashes, I make fascist crapped in pantses, stanzas, cure culture. Cancer. I got tunes that move you to dance, burn flags, anthem, throw a tantrum, getting out of hand with these random acting tactics against the axis, my word act like nominally gat, rhymely packed, punch, crash the fun by metric tons and plus my math, distribute cash among the classes, take from the thieving greedy bastard, get back like church has to get past, collapse structure, fuck facades, I destruct the support beams and bars, wrecking ball large, resistance, subversive diction, flip the shit just like a brick throne, dethrone kings, bring the trees on, my tone rock like Gibraltar pop, hip hop hotter than a rocket shot, I'm crime, think, thought, bring the big talk, teach you to flee from the flock, walk off, switch shit, hit my target, drop like bombs in the form of carpets, I got the target locked on that all shit. Pump your fist if you know where we are. That's a rap. Boom bap. Original rap at. Take it to back. Boom bap. Boom bap. I'm talking true path, master the craft, the pupil, the prof, keep dropping math. Boom bap, blast the bazooka rap. Boom bap. Original rap.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse. The talk we're about to hear by Dr. Michael Parenti is titled Rambo and the Swarthy Hordes. Michael Parenti is an author and political analyst. Among his books are The Sword and the Dollar, Inventing Reality, History is Mystery, and his latest, The Terrorism Trap. This talk was given in 1989 in North Hollywood, California, during the administration of George Bush I, an administration consisting of most of the same players that occupy positions in the present Bush administration. In the talk, Parenti looks at the entertainment media as a propaganda vehicle for American ruling class interests and attitudes. With the recent spate of war movies and TV shows glorifying the CIA, FBI, and police, this 13-year-old talk is eerily relevant. Control of media is even more concentrated now than 13 years ago, as most major media outlets are subsidiaries of massive corporations with interests in a variety of areas, including armaments. At the time this talk was given, Saddam Hussein was a great friend of the United States, and Osama bin Laden was, in the words of the great communicator Ronald Reagan, the moral equivalent of America's founding fathers.
I want to today give attention to the other side of the media, not the news media, but the entertainment media, because the entertainment media consumes a much larger share of the viewing time of most Americans than do the news programs. And I thought I would call this book something like The Hidden Political Images of the Entertainment Media, And then as I thought about it, I said, well, what's so hidden about it? It's rather blatant. And what I looked at are Hollywood films. That's what I'm studying. Hollywood films and TV dramas, TV miniseries, teleplays, and the like. What I find is a real abundance of images and ideologies, ones that are essentially supportive of imperialism, anti-communism, capitalism, racism, sexism, militarism, say militarism twice, militarism, authoritarian violence, vigilantism, and anti-working class attitudes. More specifically, I found these kinds of themes. Individual heroics predominate over collective action. There's almost no collective action. There's almost no story or drama where the people organize together and do something for themselves. I mean, there are one or two exceptions. When they do, when there is collective action, they're usually led by some hero who has to spur them on and really do the whole thing himself. Free enterprise is the best economic system in the world. That's a message which is not necessarily telegraphed so much as it is presumed. Certainly, there's nothing positive ever uttered about alternative systems in the entertainment media. Private monetary gain is a central and worthy objective of life, although those who are too wickedly greedy, the Dynasty guys and Dallas fellows, they can meet with disapproval. Sometimes business characters are insensitive to other people's needs because they're so busy with their business activities, but when properly apprised of the problems and such, they are suddenly capable of legendary acts of generosity, which I've never seen in real life, but I see on television dramas say, the kid needs the house, give it to him. I'll give the factory to Joe, he's a good guy, and all that sort of thing. Workers are beer guzzling, regular Joes, I mean, good natured and all that, but really not very bright, incapable. If I was to say any one consistent stereotype I've seen about how blue collar people are portrayed in the media, with the exception of certain films, by the way, everything I say, there are a few notable exceptions, with the exception of a film like Silkwood or A Matter of Sex, a few others, they're almost always incapable of leadership and of acting as agents of their own lives. One wonders really where labor unions came from. Labor unions are always up to not much good. They're rather insensitive to the needs of workers. Some years back, there was a TV program, Archie Bunker, All in the Family, which was supposedly against various forms of bigotry. And while it came out against the bigot, who was Archie Bunker, and made a little message statement against bigotry, every program practiced a bigotry of its own by portraying the working person as this goof and goon. And one of the big laugh lines in All in the Family was when Archie Bunker mispronounced a word, committed a malapropism, and the canned laughter would come on. That's not funny. There's nothing funny when somebody mispronounces a word. I mean, all you're saying is that he hasn't had the opportunity to have the education that some other people have had. But class bigotry is a very common form of bigotry, and it remains totally unchallenged, unlike gender bigotry or race bigotry, which at least is challenged today. The practices and forms of class bigotry go on in abundance in the media and remain unchallenged. Affluent professionals in almost all programs are considered much more interesting than blue-collar or ordinary service workers. There are many more of them as principal characters. Women and ethnic minorities are really not as capable, effective, or interesting as white males. Cop shows, the police and everyone else should be given a freer hand in combating the large criminal element in America, using generous applications of force and violence without too much attention to constitutional rights. In fact, in any number of cop shows, the cop will get up and talk about that Constitution isn't going to protect you, it's only me with my gun and the hell with the Constitution. The ills of society are caused by individual malfactors and not by anything in the socioeconomic system. No, no, no. There are some unworthy persons in our established institutions, but they are eventually dealt with and set straight for the most part. U.S. military force is directed only toward laudable goals, or more often the goals are not even stated. It's just assumed that we've got to win this one. Nothing said about what kind of interests are involved. I mean, after all, why are people doing all this fighting and killing? It's a question that remains largely unstated. Western industrial and military might, especially the U.S.'s, has been a civilizing force for the benefit of backward peoples throughout the Third World. The United States and the entire Western world have long been threatened from abroad by foreign aggressors, such as the Russians, communist terrorists, Arab terrorists, and generally the swarthy hordes of less developed peoples. Those are, I would say, some of the general themes that come up again and again in any number of movies. And the last one is the one I want to focus on today. It's the paradigm of the wagon train versus the swarthy hordes, first enunciated very well by in a marvelous article by Tom Engelhardt in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. It could be happening in the American Wild West. It could be in the Amazon jungle, the North African desert, the Sudan, the Transvaal, the South Pacific jungles, or Indochina. The scene is generally the same. There's a fort, or an encampment, or a wagon train. And inside that encampment are the human beings. They're white. They're human. They're warm, they're attractive, they talk, and they're nice. Outside come the swarthy hordes, the savages. They can be Indians, they could be Bushmen, they can be Arabs on camels and horses or whatever else. And they are the subhumans, and they are attacking the human beings. And the wagons form their circle, and the human beings know what to do. They level their guns, and they begin to knock off, shoot, and kill these screaming savages who attack them. Why do the swarthy hordes attack the white people? You don't know. They never tell you. Is it to protect their lands? Is it to protect their herds? Is it to protect their villages and their towns and their families and their children? No, it's just because they like to do that. That's their thing. They like to attack. And so they have to be killed. And by the way, it's not even bravery that they manifest as they charge in great numbers and get cut down in horrible numbers. This is not even bravery, although similar acts by whites would be portrayed as heroic. This itself is portrayed as a manifestation of the swarthy hordes, their fanatic, crazed way of wanting to bloodlust. Now, the trouble with this paradigm is that it turns the history of the last 400 years on its head. That it reverses the roles of usurper and usurped. It reverses the roles of victim and victimizer. It reverses the roles of those who were massacred and those who were doing the massacring. It was the European and North American civilizers, so-called, who went in there and destroyed the villages and destroyed their industries and destroyed their townships. Read Engels on North Africa, What Happened to the Arabs and Berbers, and when he goes in and describes the beautiful towns with the fine, hard stone and plaster buildings and their woolen industries and their mining industries and their arts and crafts and all that. And then read the description of the French troops coming in and systematically destroying it and killing every man, woman, and child. Read about how the Germans went into South Africa and killed the Herero tribe. 80,000 people, they killed 60,000 of them, and the other 20,000 they used as slave labor in their minds. Read Mark Twain's angry, raging comments about King Leopold of Belgium, calling him a mad dog and what he did to the innocent, unoffending people of the Congo, taking them and enslaving them, 1 million of them a year dying in the mines in the Congo. That's what the history's about. That's what John Wayne is about. And what these films do is they reverse that history, stand it on its head. They do what Joseph Goebbels said. They give you a big lie, and they embellish it, and they make you root for the guys in the wagon train. Now, once you kill and once you plunder like that, once you go in to take another people's land and steal their labor and enslave their labor and take their resources and preempt and take over their markets, once you do that kind of act, and it wasn't we, it wasn't the ordinary people of Europe and North America that did it, it was the ruling interest that did it, and they used our taxes, our money, and our sons to go fight. But once you do that, you have to do two other things ideologically and psychologically. One, you have to deny the humanity of your victims. They are subhumans and they are moral inferiors. As John Wayne said in one of his horse operas in 1953, He said, there's humans and then there's Comanches. A very clear message. He couldn't have said it better. There's humans and then there's Comanches. You're not killing human beings. You're killing these wild animals. By the way, you can get the same quotes from Winston Churchill about the Afghanis. You can get the same quotes from George Washington about American Indians. And you can get them from any number of imperialists. The second thing you do is you must ascribe all your crimes to them. You deny your own inhumanity and you accuse your victims of doing to you what you have been doing to them all along. Sometimes imperialism can take on an endearing, tender note, though. I found one movie which I want to share with you. It was with little, cutesy, adorable Shirley Temple. She was in the movie called, ready for this, Wee Willie Winky, 1937. And she asked her grandfather, who's the British colonel, they're off their way out in some place where the British have no business being, and she says, why are you mad at Khoda Khan, leader of the, quote, warlike tribes? The British colonel answers tenderly, oh, darling, we're not mad at Khoda Khan. England wants to be friends with all her peoples. But if we don't shoot him, he'll shoot us. This is sort of the Pat Buchanan, Cap Weinberger approach to foreign policy. Now, another interesting thing, these defamatory stereotypes and images demonstrate the unholy marriage between imperialism and racism. Marx has a very fascinating quote. I've got it in The Sword and the Dollar. Of British officers in the Sepoy Rebellion in India. It was a contemporary account. The officers said, we hanged every nigger we found. In India, they're talking about India. Use the term nigger. We hanged every nigger we found. And every Indian they came across, they hanged them. The suppression was horrible. In South Africa, the people are called Kaffirs. In the Middle East, ragheads. In Asia, slopes and gooks. Well, these terms, nigger, Kaffir, slopes, gooks, this is a vocabulary of imperialism as well as a vocabulary of racism. And indeed, I'm not going to argue that imperialism is the cause of racism, but certainly imperialism is one of the biggest instigators and propagators of it. You have to finally define whole categories of people as different and inferior to justify what you're doing. Even when the imperialism is not of the violent sort, and even when the racism is not evident, it still can permeate a film sort of implicitly. Take the case of how Hollywood has dealt with Africa. The Tarzan movies, I won't even say a word, there it's so evident and so obvious, we'll just say the Tarzan movies. Okay, I've proven my case. But let's go on. Let's go on beyond Tarzan, and let's take a more modern day effort, finally. Finally, Hollywood, finally, in the 1980s, in the last 30 years, I've been waiting for an intelligent movie about Africa. There's 1,000 stories in Africa. There are stories of tribal conflicts, of generational conflicts, of urbanization, of cultural change, of labor struggle, horrendous, incredible level of labor struggle like nothing you see in North America, like nothing you see in Europe. 250,000 gold miners out on strike together, and they don't have computers and carpools and all that sort of thing. Incredible amount of discipline and organization and courage from a people who supposedly are not ready for self-government. 1,000 stories, 1,000 dramas that you can make. And so Hollywood finally makes a movie about Africa, and it's called Out of Africa. And what's it about? It's about an upper crust Danish literati whose major concern, it seems, is to hang on to her plantation and get it together with her beautiful blonde boyfriend, Robert Redford. That's what the story was about, played by Meryl Streep. And the Africans in Out of Africa, I kept looking for the Africans. And there they were, sort of around the edges, saying things like, is Sahib happy? Does Sahib want dinner now? May I do this for Sahib? Addressing her reverently. And then Robert Redford comes along and he sets her straight, because he's kind of gone native a little, you know, and he says, I want to show you my Africa, the real Africa. I said, hey, here it comes, the breakthrough. And what does he do? He takes her up in the plane, and you see those same old aerial shots straight out of the Tarzan flicks of the zebra herds and the giraffes running along. Still no Africans. And I said, ah, this is why they named it Out of Africa, because there's nothing in Africa about it. Then finally we got to a really good film, and I do mean it, Gandhi, which at least portrayed Indian principles and showed the Indians acting with courage together, although it all came from the magic leadership of Mohandas Gandhi, apparently, and it even showed some of the brutality of the British. But even that film, I would have to make a serious criticism, because it gets to the heart of the political economy of the entertainment media, and that is that the political economy of imperialism was never shown in that otherwise fine film. The forced underdevelopment and impoverishment of India by British capitalism was never shown. The fact that when the British went into India between 1830 and 1900, the per capita earnings of the Indians dropped by two-thirds. That India was pillaged. That poverty was not an original condition of India. India is a lush, fertile subcontinent. The poverty of India is a direct cause of the policies of British imperialism, which was to forcibly deindustrialize India. That could have been dealt with in some way. You know, you could say, well, you know, I mean, what do you want, Parenti? How can you do that in a film? I mean, you can't start reading tracts of Lenin in the middle of a film, or chapter 3 from The Sword and the Dollar, you know, you just can't do that. But during the course of a movie, you can have some discussion, some word explaining what are the British doing in India. I sat for 3.5 hours through that film, and they never explain why are the British in India? What are they doing there? And you're left with the impression that they're in India simply because they like to strut about with their swagger sticks, and they simply don't have the decency to go home when asked to go home. But in fact, very powerful British interests got very rich off the land, the labor, the resources, and the markets of India. A film that really deals in an uncompromising way, and in a very good way, it's not a particularly well-made film, but the script and the political content of it is terrific, was made in 1969. It deals with imperialism, the political economy of imperialism, too, and that was called Burn, an Italian-French production. It's nice to hear applause from the 7 people who were able to see that movie, because the distribution of that movie was remarkable. I mean, it actually dealt with the class interest behind it, dealt with the transition from slavery to free labor. You had Marlon Brando explaining why it'd be better, it would have less costs and all that sort of thing. This movie was suppressed in its distribution. It was taken out of circulation. It did not reach many theaters, and it did not stay long in the ones it did reach. And it would make a nice little story as to what happened to the distribution of that movie. There's another area where the wagon train paradigm exists, and that's right in the urban frontier. It's what Hal Himmelstein, in his book on television, calls the urban frontier. It's the fort, the wagon train, the encampment all over again, but it's in the middle of the city. Again, you've got the human beings, and they are under siege, and they are under siege again from swarthy hordes. There are plenty of TV shows, as you know, and plenty of movies. Let me just give you one called Cobra by Sylvester Stallone, who wrote it and acted in it. The comedian Jay Leno was right. Stars like Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone deserve a lot of credit for opening up the acting profession to a lot of people who could not get into it back when speech was a requirement. Cobra is, and by the way, this has been a standard character over the last 20 years, in the last 15 years or so, in films and TV series. He's a whacked out Vietnam vet, bitter, wounded, angry that he couldn't win it. He wanted to win it, and you didn't let him win it. So now he's a detective in New York, and he fights the whole gang, and they are trying to terrorize and take over the city, or the country, or the world. It's not clear. And so it's cowboy versus Indians, cowboy singular, cowboy versus Indians. And Cobra goes out there, and again, the same thing, makes his talks about you pussyfooting with the Constitution and all these rights, and I'm going to do it my way, and I'll really take care of them. And Cobra doesn't believe in sissy things like arrest, trial, and incarceration. He just executes these guys. He just murders people, and one of the gang guys he captures, he douses him with gasoline, and then he lights a match. As he sets fire to the guy, he sneeringly says, "You have the right to remain silent." Now, the most durable version of the swarthy hordes, that external alien menace that's going to come at us, is the red tide and the red menace. You can defeat the Indians and the Bushmen, but communism is still around there, and it will subvert us from within, or it will inundate us from without. You remember Ronald Reagan's speech about Nicaragua? If we don't stop them in Nicaragua, the red tide will be lapping at our borders. That Nicaragua is only 12 hours drive from Brownsville, Texas. That's if you drive 180 miles an hour, but whatever. Well, that basic paradigm, that image, is being propagated by our presidents, our political leaders. And in the 1980s, the Reaganite cinema reached new heights of anti-communism, and Soviet bashing reached new depths, I should say. Rambo 2 with Sylvester Stallone. In Rambo 2, Stallone, he not only acts, if you want to call it that, acts in these roles, he also writes the scripts. And he turns around in that movie and he says to his old Green Beret commander, he says, "Are we going to fight to win it this time?" And he certainly does win it. He goes into Vietnam and he kills a battalion of Russians. He kills the whole Vietnamese army. They throw napalm at him. He's captured by them, he's tortured, and he liberates prisoners of war. He's aided by the fact that his adversaries all seem to be legally blind. They cannot shoot straight. Hundreds of rounds are shot at him and they just always miss, never fluff his hair. But while the movie is outrageous and it's ridiculous, again, don't lose sight of the fact that it's once more turning history on its head. I mean, in reality, the Vietnamese have exchanged prisoners of war with the United States after signing the Paris Peace Agreement, which ended the war. And that whole POW-MIA issue is really an outrageous pandering exploitation of the unrealistic hopes of those families conducted by the Pentagon and the U.S. government and played upon by people like Ronald Reagan. You know, there are 18,000 Americans missing in action from World War II. Where do you suppose they are? Are they being held captive in Toyota factories or in beer cellars in Wiesbaden someplace or something? No, tragically, unfortunately, sadly, they're dead, and it's acknowledged that they're dead. But the 2,000-some missing from Vietnam have never been acknowledged realistically for what they are, which is that they're dead. Instead, that issue is exploited. It's not only exploited, but whole movies are made out of it. Not just Rambo 2, but Missing in Action 1, Missing in Action 2, Missing in Action 3, Bradford, Missing in Action 4, I think, is coming up soon. Second, U.S. prisoners of war were not tortured by the Soviets in Vietnam, as depicted in this film. They have Rambo being tortured by Russians. There is no historical record of that. There is, however, a record of South Vietnamese-trained forces and U.S. special forces using all sorts of torture, electric shock, water treatment tortures on National Liberation Force fighters. Third, the Soviets did not drop napalm on anyone in Vietnam. You know who dropped the napalm in Vietnam. Just complete turning around. The U.S. dropped huge amounts of napalm and Agent Orange, something like 20% of the land. The whole food chain in Vietnam has been tainted. Vietnam was a country that had no liver cancer. It was an unknown disease because people ate sensible food like rice and grains and vegetables. And today it has one of the highest rates of liver cancer in the world because of what we did to their ecology chain. That's not what you get in the film. I guess you can get that kind of lying from somebody like Sylvester Stallone. If he could portray himself as a fearless war hero, even though he spent the Vietnam era working in a private girls' school in Europe, why would we expect him to play straight with the larger history, right? Rambo 3, Rambo is in Afghanistan now. And the Soviets are portrayed as sadists, rapists, and torturers who murder little children with explosive toys, a horror story that originated, propagated by the CIA, for which there's no evidence. I don't know, the Red Army has got better things to do than put toys down to blow up kids' fingers. For fun, good old Rambo sends a Soviet captive plummeting. He takes him, puts a noose around his neck, and he throws him off a cave shaft down to his death. And then for still more fun, Rambo dynamites him. blows him up. He had him rigged up and he sets him off. What a guy, that Rambo. He gets along real swell with the Mujahideen killers, the feudal land owners, the Islamic fanatics, and the opium growers, the guys who took up guns when the Kabul government said that their women could take the veils off and their women could go to school and their children could go to school. They took up guns, laughably described as the Afghan freedom fighters. Those of you who supported them, I hope you continue to support and watch how they operate and what they stand for. Let me say that Rambo gets along real well with them. By the end of this third and worst of the Rambo films, our hero has sort of mellowed out a little. He gives his good luck charm to an adoring 12-year-old Afghan boy soldier who himself has shown killing Russians on several occasions. War is a kind of a healing, nurturing experience for Rambo. You know, in Rambo 1, which I didn't mention, he was a borderline psychotic. He got into all sorts of trouble. He was a Vietnam veteran who was just psyched and freaked out. By the end of